KDW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. On the campaign trail, former President Trump returns to Butler, Pennsylvania today, holding a rally at the site of July's assassination attempt. Vice President Kamala Harris will be in North Carolina surveying the damage caused by Hurricane Helene there. More than 220 people have died, and search and rescue operations continue in the southeast. Mary Ann Tierney is regional administrator for FEMA. She assured residents federal relief is available.
This is a long road, and FEMA will be with you every step of the way.
As fears of a wider Middle East war grow, Israeli authorities ordering more evacuations in southern Lebanon. More than 1 million already displaced there. American Lebanese citizen Samir Bawab evacuated on a flight to Istanbul.
Many people are waiting at the airport all day just so they can get their grandparents out, their mom out, or their daughters out. It's completely tragic.
Israel also vowing to respond to Iran's missile strike this week. This is ABC News. Friday Night Lights was more than just football last night. The Georgia high school, rocked by a deadly shooting last month, taking another step toward healing.
The stands were packed.
Please join us in a moment of silence and prayer.
Appalachee High School in Winder, Georgia, playing its first home game a month after two students and two teachers died in a school shooting. Football coach Ricky Aspinwall was one of the victims. Leading the team in his absence, assistant coach Matt Bradley.
One of the hardest things that I've ever had to deal with in my life.
Taylor Wheeler, a former student, brought her kids along.
It was very close to home, and when they say that, I don't think you really understand until it happens.
The opposing Jackson County football team warming up in Appalachian strong shirts. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Fans are mourning the loss of former Detroit Lions quarterback and assistant coach Greg Landry. The NFL team announced his death on social media yesterday. The New England native started with the Lions in 1968 and went on to the then Baltimore Colts. Landry was 77 years old. Michelle Franzen, ABC News.
I don't know about other states, but in Wisconsin, we help our neighbors and love our communities. But California mega millionaire Eric Hovde doesn't seem to get that. Maybe that's why he questioned whether children should be able to stay on their parents' insurance until they're 26. And whether people in nursing homes should be able to vote. Hovde called for raising the retirement age for hardworking Wisconsinites and making obese people pay more for health care. And a Hovde company even spent decades trying to demolish the building housing Madison's oldest family-owned bar. Something they finally did this year, shuttering a treasured neighborhood institution for good. That is not how we do things in Wisconsin. And that is why we can't let California mega millionaire Eric Hovde represent us.
Paid for by a Better Wisconsin Together Action. ABWT-action.org. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anywhere at the WGBW website, WGBW.fm.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A program that helps cover the cost of replacing polluted wells is popular in Wisconsin, but officials say more permanent changes are needed. Mike Moan reports.
Running your kitchen faucet and suspecting the water is contaminated can be a scary thought. Tom Van Lowe and his wife live in a farming community in Marathon County. Their property is surrounded by cropland. Van Lowe says over time they had a buildup of nitrates in their well, with test results eventually showing excessive levels. County officials helped them apply for aid through the state well compensation grant program, which funded a reverse osmosis system. That was a lifesaver for the couple.
We knew for years that we were drinking contaminated water, so it gave us a lot of peace of mind.
Benlo says they likely wouldn't have been able to afford the roughly $12,000 cost, and they no longer have to stock up on bottled water. Agencies and assistance groups report waiting lists for these grants, saying eligibility is pretty restrictive. Chase Cummings of the Dunn County Environmental Services Department says that existing eligibility requirements for the well compensation program make it hard for people to clean up their drinking water.
Nitrate concentrations must exceed 40 parts per million. The health standard is 10 parts per million. So you'd have to have a very high nitrate concentration in your private well. And if you were to use the current well comp program eligibility, we would have one individual eligible.
That puts many other property owners in a bind because they don't qualify. Cummings says county governments are being more intentional about careful land use. That includes working with farmers to adopt conservation practices so that lower levels of nitrate find their way to surrounding water sources. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Mostly sunny and windy today. Highs near 73. Winds out of the southeast over 30 miles per hour at times. For tonight, scattered showers and storms. Lows around 55. For Sunday, sunny and breezy with a high near 60 degrees. On Monday, sunshine and 65.
Right now, 71 degrees.
Broadcasting from the City Deck Studios on North Washington Street, the talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
Hey, political orphans, swing voters, undecideds, independents, wherever you are. Welcome to a special series of episodes we're doing for Lost in the Middle on sort of a countdown to the election, which is now just coming up terribly close right in front of us. So, quick story. I had three boys, and my oldest is 4 years younger than the middle one, and my youngest one is 3 years younger than the middle one. And so we had two through college, and then goes the youngest away to school. And there were, for anybody whose parents know, there's adventures along the way with kids. They tend to peak in the middle school years, and in college they go learn about a lot about themselves. Something's good and something's bad. And one early morning, the phone rings on a Sunday, and we can tell it's my youngest son, Colin, calling in from Minnesota where he went to school. And, I said, "Hey, Colin, what's going on?" And he goes, "Hey, Dad, you'll never guess what I did last night." And it's like, "Colin, you had two brothers before you. I can't imagine it's anything they didn't do. Does it involve law enforcement?" And he said, "No, Dad, I actually went and did stand-up. It's something I always wanted to do." And there became Colin's journey for the better part of his years in college and a few years afterwards, where he actually went out to Los Angeles with some buddies and sort of took a run at the big time. And along came COVID. So it was a pretty frustrating 15 months for Colin and his other buddies who we went with him. But our guest this morning, Justin Young, is a great podcaster, great perspective on politics, and hosts a podcast called Politics, Politics, Politics. And I had the chance to be on it a while back. But he's also a comedian along the way soon. So since
where the fans own the team, this is the talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. On the campaign trail, former President Trump returns to Butler, Pennsylvania today, holding a rally at the site of July's assassination attempt. Vice President Kamala Harris will be in North Carolina surveying the damage caused by Hurricane Helene there. More than 220 people have died, and search and rescue operations continue in the southeast. Mary Ann Tierney is regional administrator for FEMA. She assured residents federal relief is available.
"This is a long road, and FEMA will be with you every step of the way."
As fears of a wider Middle East war grow, Israeli authorities ordering more evacuations in southern Lebanon. More than 1 million already displaced there. American Lebanese citizen Samir Bawab evacuated on a flight to Istanbul.
"Many people are waiting at the airport all day just so they can get their grandparents out, their mom out, or their daughters out. It's completely tragic."
Israel also vowing to respond to Iran's missile strike this week. This is ABC News.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the civic.
Hey, political orphans, swing voters, undecideds, independents, wherever you are. Welcome to a special series of episodes we're doing for Lost in the Middle and sort of a countdown to the election, which is now just coming up terribly close, right in front of us. So, quick story. I had three boys, and my oldest is 4 years younger than the middle one, and my youngest one is 3 years younger than the middle one. And so we had two through college, and then goes the youngest away to school. And there were, for anybody who's parents, know there's adventures along the way with kids. They tend to peak in the middle school years, and in college they go learn about a lot about themselves. Something's good and something's bad. And one early morning, the phone rings on a Sunday, and we can tell it's my youngest son, Colin, calling in from Minnesota where he went to school. And I said, "Hey, Colin, what's going on?" And he goes, "Hey, Dad, you'll never guess what I did last night." And it's like, Colin, you had two brothers before you. I can't imagine it's anything they didn't do. Does it involve law enforcement? And he said, "No, Dad, I actually went and did stand-up. It's something I always wanted to do." And there became Colin's journey for the better part of his years in college and a few years afterwards, where he actually went out to Los Angeles with some buddies and sort of took a run at the big time. And along came COVID. So it was a pretty frustrating 15 months for Colin and his other buddies who we went with him. But our guest this morning, Justin Young, is a great podcaster, great perspective on politics, and hosts a podcast called Politics, Politics, Politics. And I had the chance to be on it a while back. But he's also a comedian along the way soon. So since we just are sort of coming out of the wake of the presidential debate, Justin, before we get into serious conversations, explain to me about the card game you based on the presidential election in 2020.
Yeah, well, actually, the card game's called The Contender. I made two card games, but that is the only politically themed one. It is the game of presidential debate. It is available wherever you might find
presidential debate paraphernalia.
Yeah, exactly. But it came from a real love of presidential debates. I've just always really liked them. I came of age during the Clinton era. One of the first campaigns that I can remember was the 92 race, where I was old enough to kind of know the gravity of things. But since then, and especially for that project, my co-creator John Teasdale and I went back and watched every presidential debate that we could find and found real quotes from presidential debates spanning the entire history of our country, or campaign quotes through the entire history of our country. And when you play the game, you in real time can go back and forth with your friends and family debating. And then one of you will be the judge and determine who's totally subjectively won the day, the way that we really do it in the media.
So when you say you went back before Kennedy, Nixon, or was that the starting point?
Yeah. We had to stretch the definition of where we wanted to get quotes from. So we wound up going with famous campaign quotes and stuff like that. But we tried to, as best we could, hew to quotes that were said in the pursuit of the presidency, and not necessarily as president.
And you still sell them?
Obviously, the meat. It's available on Amazon. It's available wherever you might find stuff. It was a tremendous journey. We started it in 2015, really, and we were working with a few people. Then all of a sudden, I remember even putting into our Slack that Donald Trump was getting into the race, and I'm like, "Oh, this is going to get so much attention. We're going to sell a lot of games." It obviously went in a direction that we had never really intended. And, you know, Donald Trump, for better and for worse, now the Cal Ripken Jr. of presidential debates, with seven under his belt more than anybody else, really has revolutionized in his own era. Or I would say he has defined in his own era what a presidential debate is. for better or worse.
Yeah, we'll leave that to our listeners to decide, but
yeah,
it's not hard to figure out. You started out in journalism. So
yes.
Tell me how that, your early days working at the University of Syracuse, and by the way, they never should have left the Big East. Just an aside here, as a college basketball.
I was there when that happened.
Yeah. They'd be much better off playing Connecticut, playing Marquette and Pittsburgh than Wake Forest. Who cares?
Yeah. I mean, let's just totally sidetrack into collegiate conferences because, or just for basketball. You want to know what? For football, they can play whoever they want. Like Syracuse football is, I think, at its best. I actually kind of like it a little bit more when every once in a while Syracuse can upset Clemson. But now I really miss in the fall when you don't get those classic Big East rivalry games. You don't get the Georgetowns, the Pittsburghs. I mean, I guess now some of them have reconstituted, but it really was a connection to an element of sports that I didn't grow up with because I grew up in South Florida. So being able to plug into this mid-Atlantic, East Coast sort of a rivalry was like really, really fun. And now, like many things with sports, it's just been totally reshaped for really, really dumb reasons. But that's not why I went to Syracuse, although I obviously give off the impression of having tremendous athletic prowess and being learned there on some sort of scholarship. No, I was a journalism nerd, and I was just one of those kids that read the newspaper every day and had my favorite writers and columnists and knew from a young age that I wanted to be a journalist before you even really know exactly what that means. It's in a lot of ways, the proto-journalist is really a combination of vanity of wanting to see your name somewhere that everybody else sees it and gossip monger. But I applied to the Newhouse School up there in Syracuse, was very lucky to get accepted, and immediately realized that I didn't like college, but I loved the Daily Orange, which was and still is the longest running independent student newspaper in the country. It's been around for over 100 years. And that's where I spent all of my time. And, you know, I went to school in the fall of 2001, obviously a few weeks into my first semester. The day after, I became a professional journalist because I got the job at the Daily Orange, which does pay, the day before 9/11 happens. And that pretty much sets me on my way for learning the hard way exactly what it means to be a reporter.
And so why did you leave journalism?
You know, I didn't intend to do it for long. I wanted to do comedy. So I came out of school. I totally misjudged the world of journalism. I was very frustrated with, you know, as all 20-somethings, I knew everything. And I totally thought everybody was stupid unless they allowed me to totally reshape the business of journalism as I saw fit, because it was clearly the correct answer. And I will say I was half right. Mostly what I wanted was more of a internet influence and more of an ability to reach people in my generation where they were currently. And so I was frustrated with where journalism was as I was graduating in 2005, because I saw a lot of glut of a real golden age of journalists that had, kind of ossified in the top ends of these journalistic institutions that I revered. And I just kind of assumed they were never going away, which was, I guess, was a childish thought to assume that nothing was ever going to change.
Well, except
but
now,
these are a lot of the same.
Except now the newspapers have gone away. That's the.
Well, that's so here's what happened. What happened is literally I decided I went, I'll go try comedy for a couple of years. And then the same job that was available to me right out of school, which was covering cops in Utica, New York. It's probably going to be available to me, you know, in 2 years. So let me just go give this comedy thing a try. And then what happened was all that ossified top end all got bought out literally in like 24 months. It was ridiculous. And all my friends that had jumped right into these newspaper jobs were now at the top of their beats. Like I had friends that came in to, you know, they were covering high school soccer as their, you know, in their first month. And then they're covering the Red Sox for the Boston Globe in like, you know, 11 months because there was so much talent that was bought out. And I'm like, oh, wow, well, I really, really misjudged that. But as life had it, I wound up founding, you know, a couple blogs, and I was working with a friend of mine in just these internet pursuits. And it's not that I ever really feel like I left journalism. I guess I did initially, but I really, there was a moment where new media and journalism were two very, very, very different things. And I think as I talk to you now, in a world where a kind of independent journalist is not quite the dirty word that it used to be, there's enough top talent that have formed their own Substacks that the whole industry of people outside of the system has kind of been legitimized. I like to think from this point, if I can retcon my own journey, I never really left journalism. I was a frontiersman, Scott. I was panning for gold and settling the land. And now there's a hotel and a community theater.
Well, and the other thing that's happened, and you know, this is my prejudice in this, is that if you look at surveys of American journalists, the dearth of Republicans is breathtaking. I mean, there's so little.
Yeah.
There's so little conservative influence. I mean, aside from Fox, whatever Fox is, whether it's a real news show or not, we could. Mm-hmm. There's no argument about it. I mean, it's entertainment. But if you look, you know, at the recent decision by a senior editor at NPR to quit when he checked the voter registration for everybody in the newsroom. It was 97-0 Democrats. Nate Silver, hardly a bastion of conservative thought when he was at the New York Times, did a study, and only 6% of the journalists in the country self-identified as Republicans. So from my perspective, I just think there's a groupthink in journalism that really frustrates me. And I think you can see that in a lot of the political coverage today.
You're right. I was going to say, I don't doubt it. I know you're right, because I know. Here's what I always say. I know the pipelines that go from the Daily Orange, where I worked, to the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Boston Globe. I can name the people. Like, if I wanted to go work there, I know the people that I would call. I don't assume that there is one of those for Liberty University. I don't think that there is one of those for Bob Jones. And I know the people that came to my school, and they were all, you know, well-meaning liberal kids from liberal places in the country.
Got it. We'll be back in just a minute. We'll talk a little bit more about the election itself. My guest, Justin Young. Stick around. The host of Politics, Politics, Politics.
This podcast is brought to you by the American Property Owners Alliance. Our country recognizes home ownership as one of the best ways to build wealth and stable communities. But over the years, support for home ownership has dwindled, and our leaders have lost sight of its value. We're working to change that. The American Property Owners Alliance is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that holds our leaders accountable to safeguard homeowners and communities. Visit PropertyOwnersAlliance.org to learn more and find out how you can join our efforts.
The Todd Alba Show.
Going back to this interview we just had, again, many thanks to Michael Cohen, former attorney and fixer for Donald Trump. Let's go back to the phone lines. Don in Milwaukee. Don, thanks for holding. What say you?
My God, that I've been listening to your station, Civic Media, for a long time, and this was a blockbuster. I was absolutely riveted.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Today's U.S. Bowling League Day. I am not in a bowling league. I think that would actually be kind of fun.
Oh, yeah.
I do like to bowl. But
you got the bowling shirt going on tonight there, Pete.
I do have the bowling shirt. In case the game breaks out, I'm ready. Because I was raised, I'm a street bowler, Chris. I'm ready in case a game breaks out. It could happen.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Hell yeah! So welcome back. This is a special edition of Lost in the Middle with some of America's best political podcast hosts. I've had a chance to be on Justin Young's show before, which is why I dragged him on to this special episode of our show. So talk to me about your sense of who the undecided voters are left in America. Because if you talk to people who are political junkies, they can't believe somebody hasn't made up their mind. And they're very righteous about it on one side or the other. So who are the orphans? Who are the undecideds? Who are the swing voters that are still straggling to the polls?
There is an amazing New York Times editorial or opinion piece that I remember from the 2004 election, written by the great Larry David of Curb Your Enthusiasm and Seinfeld fame, just excoriating the concept of the undecided voter. And the line that I always remember is, if you can't decide who to vote for, and I think at that point it was Bush versus Kerry, then just grab a pint of ice cream and go into bed, which is always something that me and my friends have repeated forever. Who are the undecided voters? Well, I think that the big question there is, where is our media system right now? Because the one thing that we've lost, certainly from the time where you were in office and when I grew up, is a central media hub where everybody either read the newspaper, listened to radio, or watched the nightly news, not morning or nightly news, right? But there was some kind of a general through line for which there was common truth to be understood, and there was a saturation where everybody either saw it themselves or were told about it. We don't live in that world anymore. Everything is fractured. So if you want to find the undecided voter, I would say find the person for whom there is no political content that gets to them ever. If all you do is go to work, come home, and watch anime, then you're not going to get a lot of dialogue on whether or not Springfield, Ohio has a problem with cats being eaten. You're not going to hear about whether or not Kamala Harris was for banning fracking before she was against banning fracking. Like that is just a place where you're not seeing it. And so my guess is the undecided voters that are going to determine this election live in obviously the appropriate states that are going to be very, very close. Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada. I don't believe that North Carolina is one of them. I think North Carolina is fool's gold for the Democrats. It always pulls left in, you know, the run up to this, and then it winds up going right, at least in the last few cycles. But in those states that I just listed, you know, I think that they're low information voters, and I don't mean that in the pejorative that they are stupid or not educated, although some of them might have a lesser education level than others. But I just don't think that they get a lot of political news, and we'll see if the noise gets so loud that some of it seeps through.
So Amy Water, who's the editor of the Cook Report, was a guest on one of our episodes about the seven places that'll decide the election. And she said, which I thought was the best take of all, she said, most voters who haven't made up their mind are the same way that I'm an NFL football fan. Like, I know the season is starting, and I sort of half cheer for the Bears because I grew up in Chicago. My brother lives in Baltimore. He's a big Ravens fan, so I sort of watch those scores. But I don't know who got drafted. I don't know what free agent was around. I don't know any of that stuff. And four or five times a year, I'll watch the games. As it gets closer to the Super Bowl, I'll get excited. And I think that was the perfect explanation because, especially in late summer, people are trying to get kids back to school. It's the last 2 weeks of vacation. It's sort of the here comes the fall. And I think that's a lot of it. And they're casual voters, and not in the sense that they don't take the election seriously, but casual in that their life doesn't revolve around politics. So who's going to win that swath? I mean, why? You know, if they don't know Trump by this time, how long will it take them to figure him out? And if they're curious about Harris, they could have found out. But I guess I'm interested in why they're on the knife's edge as they appear to be.
So if we are to assume in the same way that Amy described, and that is an amazing outlet, Cook, then we are assuming that these voters are a little bit outside the sphere of influence in the way that sickos like you and I are, and anybody listening to this show that are very concerned about politics, very interested in the TikTok of it. So in that case, you really just have a Rorschach test on Trump. Donald Trump is the definitional figure of this era of politics, and I don't think that there is any question about it. This is all about whether or not where you think about Donald Trump now, because part of his brand is that he is somebody that stays in the center of things so long that you can define him either by him or you can define him by his enemies. And so when in 2016, he was the outsider. The system was the enemy. Hillary Clinton, an unlikable Democrat, was the enemy. And he wins. In 2020, it's all about him. COVID is happening, the lockdown's there. It's a tremendously scarring thing for many, both financially and emotionally. And he's ranting and raving every day on your television. You don't like him. Joe Biden might not be around a lot, but he's old Joe. You remember the Obama administration. Let's go get back under the warm blanket and take the Biden train. That's how it wins. And then we have now, which... I'm thrilled to read the post-ops of this election because it has taken so many turns. We don't even remember the fact that we thought this election was going to be defined on Donald Trump's trials. That didn't happen. We are already on a second assassination attempt. And the first one was largely swept under the tide of a candidate willfully stepping down, the latest that a sitting president has ever done so in our modern era. So my guess is, and this is where I would say I tend to be a fundamentals guy with this stuff, we're in a 60-30 wrong track, right track environment. So that means that the majority of America believes that things are not going well and they want things to be different. It's why Kamala is running as a change candidate, despite the fact that she's in office. But at the same time, Donald Trump is a hard capped 48% guy. There are independents that are just never going to decide different on Trump. They have made up their minds. That's that. So my guess is that If you are a random NFL fan and you are deciding who you're going to root for in the Super Bowl, it's going to be about how you feel about Tom Brady. The Tom Brady in this case being Donald Trump.
It's an interesting observation. Yeah, it's interesting to me that, you know, there's three things you have to do in a race, right? I have to define you. I have to define myself. Yeah. And then you have to fight over the issues. And it seems to me the great struggle for Harris... she did very well, I thought, in the debate talking about abortion issues. But the great struggle is the top two issues she's upside down on. You know, she's upside down on the economy, and you can roll out Nobel Prize winners who say this is going well and the market's trending this way and the interest rates are coming down. But people now in a lot of quarters find it expensive to go to McDonald's, that they canceled part of their summer trip because they couldn't do it. And then the other thing is immigration, and it's crazy, and I say that in all capital letters, underscore, exclamation point, whatever you want to put out there. The cat story was it keeps immigration at the forefront of the news, which is what he wants, whether that was his plan or whether that was just a rift that sort of took off in one way or the other. But look, we'll be back in just a minute, and we're going to pick more up here with my buddy Justin Young of Politics, Politics, Politics right after this. Here's the team behind Lost in the Middle. Executive producer Jeff Mayers. Producer Todd Elbaugh. Edited by Aaron Zummers. Production at Civic Media. And a quick thanks to our partners at the American Property Owners Alliance.
From I-43 to I-41. This is the Talk of Green Bay. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Mostly sunny and windy today. Highs near 73. Winds out of the southeast over 30 miles per hour at times. For tonight, scattered showers and storms. Lows around 55. For Sunday, sunny and breezy with a high near 60 degrees. On Monday, sunshine and 65.
Right now, 71 degrees.
Progressive knows finding your new home was a dream come true. You wanted it close to town, with a picture window overlooking a yard. And you found it. Now, when you sit down to dinner, you've got front row seats too. Your neighbor's daily pickleball game. Progressive can't save you from your noisy neighbors, but we can save you money when you bundle your home and auto with us. Get a quote at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company affiliates and other insurers not available in all states.
Progressive presents...
From the home of the frozen tundra, Green Bay's choice for news talk, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
Hey, welcome back to Lost in the Middle with my friend Justin Young, host of Politics, Politics, Politics. We're spending some time in September and October talking with folks who run great political podcasts. And as I said, I had a treat to spend some time with Justin. So, Justin, tell me, here we are. It's election night. You just made some potato skins in the oven and poured yourself a beer. And you're going to watch the results. Where's your eyeball going to go?
My thought has been since the Kamala Harris ascension that this is about Pennsylvania and Georgia. So Georgia will close. I think they're both fully East Coast. So I don't think that there's any part of them that are in the central time zone. But yeah, that's it. I don't believe that Kamala Harris has a path outside if she loses Pennsylvania. And I think that if a candidate that is young, directionally opposed to Donald Trump for the reasons that she is kind of in the demographic perspective, and Black, then you need to turn out the Metro Atlanta area. Like that is the perfect collection of never Trumpers plus Black and progressive, more progressive for a red state area, that if she does not turn that out, then I don't think that she has a shot. Those are the two states that I think matter the most.
So let's talk about Georgia, which is interesting because, excuse me, that if you look in before 2000, Georgia was a solidly Democratic state. No question about it. The heart of the Jimmy Carter run for president in 1976. And then a Republican governor gets elected and it turns completely upside down in 2 years. And then it's as red can be. Until now, you see the fast growing Atlanta suburbs that are sort of the eastern collar of Atlanta, which have grown dramatically. Atlanta and Charlotte are probably the two hot places in the country for young Black professionals to move. It's changed completely. And so now you get these places just outside of Atlanta that were very comfortable suburban Republican voting districts that have shifted. So I think you're right there. On the other hand, here's the thing that intrigued me in 2022, because, political science professors hate the idea of ticket splitting. They tell you it's this quaint old custom that used to happen. But boy, in Georgia, Republican governor, Democratic incumbent senator, and Kemp and Warnock could not be more different. And so that's why I think Georgia's an interesting test case to see what's going to happen in the presidential election.
And I would only say that we do have to factor in the Herschel Walker part of that. And to go back to the Trump side of it, and to use another football analogy, since we've used so many of them, Donald Trump's coaching tree is horrendous. Like, there are some people for whom can bring up candidates below them, but like Bill Belichick, everybody that got a job under him, terrible. They were all awful. Nobody was good. Donald Trump, the same way. He is maybe one of the most gifted in the moment politicians and message shapers that we have ever seen, even when it looks insane, like you pointed out before. Is it outrageous, if not among the more bizarrely racist things that's ever been said in a debate, that Haitian immigrants are eating the dogs, eating the cats, eating the pets of the people of Springfield? Yes. Does it highlight the fact that 20,000 Haitian immigrants were brought in by fiat of the federal government to a town of 50,000? And does that make some people say, whoa, wait a minute, I didn't know that was the case? Yes. Now, everybody that he has picked, and especially through 2022, was, aside from J.D. Vance, a total dog. Oz was a dog. Laxalt, Herschel Walker. They lost these winnable races in a way that could have been avoided if candidate recruitment had been done outside of the ballroom at Mar-a-Lago, which is essentially what happened.
Well, and if you look at the election in Georgia, I mean, if he had simply shut up after the election, they would have won both of the special elections. Instead, he cost them both Senate seats.
Scott, I was there in Dalton, Georgia that night, January 4th.
The carpet capital of America?
Yes. Dalton, Georgia. Drove out. Oh, my God. This was an era, and I don't know if they're still doing this, but they would have these Trump rallies at these, like, random airfields that were just the biggest pain in the butt to get to. Anyway, it was voter suppression. It was essentially an hour of voter suppression. And I'm out there talking to the people that are at the rally. And I'm like, are you going to vote? No. Why? Because they ripped it off from Trump. They, you know, you can't trust it. My vote doesn't count. My vote doesn't matter. And, you know, Scott Perdue has COVID. Kelly Loeffler is just totally in over her head. She has no idea what's going on. She's probably, you know, just checking her stock ticker, waiting until she can get back to the vacation home. And yeah, I agree with you. I think he is an exceptional, and again, definitional candidate of his era. He cannot have influence over a party if you want it to succeed, because he does not have that organizational, that big tent instinct of, hey, in Georgia, even if I hate Brian Kemp, does he have like a son or, you know, an old buddy of his that wants to be senator? Because I think that whoever Brian Kemp really likes should run for Senate, because Brian Kemp's extraordinarily popular. And if he's going to be out on the stump every single day saying that this guy should be senator, I got a good hope that it's going to happen. But instead, it was Herschel Walker, and we were talking about vampires in the last 3 weeks of the cycle.
Well, and, you know, the other thing with Herschel Walker, when he ran, he had a daughter. And then along the way, suddenly somebody breaks the story that he has a son. And then wait, yeah, there's more. Then he has another son. It's like you run for office and don't bother to describe to people how many children you have. You think that might come out at some point? So, yeah, maybe. It was crazy. Yeah, so that's Georgia, which can be very, very swingy. And if you look, you know, around the country again in 2022, which will be interesting in this election cycle, you know, the most popular politician in Vermont's not Bernie Sanders. It's the Republican governor who's been elected four times now, Phil Scott. If you look in other places around the country, Wisconsin's another good ticket splitter example. We reelect the Democratic governor and reelect the Republican senator. So the Democrats have a tough battleground this time in Senate races. Now, there's some races like in Wisconsin and in Ohio where they're outpolling Harris, which is interesting. And in Ohio, it's really interesting because Sherrod Brown, who's been there for a long time, Sherrod's an old buddy of mine, very liberal Democrat, on a one-on-one basis, terrific guy. But the Republican governor of Ohio last time out, Mike DeWine, got 67% of the vote. I mean, you think California is a Democratic state, you know, Newsom only got 59%. So it'll be interesting to see what's going to happen in the presidential race and how that's going to impact the Senate. If I had to put money on the table today, I think the Republicans win the Senate.
Oh, I think that race is kind of decided when you talk about the Democratic brand in Georgia just tanking overnight. That is a slow motion. That is a tectonic plate level slow motion change compared to the rapid erosion of Democratic viability in West Virginia that happened the second that Joe Manchin said he wasn't going to run for Senate again. And now Jim Justice and his absolute dump truck of a dog are going to go to Washington as the senator of West Virginia, without a doubt. You add that to Tim Sheehy in Montana, who is now consistently polling over John Tester, and that's essentially your ball game for control of the Senate. The big question is, are Republicans in a extraordinarily favorable map going to add to that? And I would agree with you that Bernie Moreno in Ohio is probably their best bet outside of it. I don't know if I buy these polls coming out of Maryland, which have Larry Hogan running as a very Joe Manchin-esque wild card, but a Republican vote nonetheless in Maryland are to be believed. But right now, at least according to the NRSC, that's their third or fourth, depending on where you believe it, best opportunity for a pickup. And then beyond that, you know, it's really going to be about turnout and exactly where these things land in specifically states like Nevada, the people on the ground in Nevada believe that this is the best chance that the Republicans have to not only win the state in the presidential, but also in the Senate in several years. And then Arizona, where you've got a incredibly polarizing candidate in Carrie Lake, or as I like to pronounce her name because she's from television, Carrie Lake. but then Ruben Gallego, who I think has skated in this cycle. He's got a lot of weird baggage. He had a busted up marriage with the mayor of Phoenix, I believe, his ex-wife, that he cheated on her with a lobbyist. None of that stuff has come out in the way that I was thinking it was going to when this was going to be a three-way race with Kyrsten Sinema, the erstwhile senator from that state, at least currently. Instead, it's just sort of become a straight RD race with Carrie Lake having the baggage of the last run. And, you know, we'll see. But my guess is that you probably get three seats if you're the Republicans. If I were to handicap it now, I would set the line at either 2.5 or 3.5, depending on how much you believed in Bernie Moreno. But I do believe that he'll probably outrun the current polling and take out Sherrod Brown. That's a rough race.
So, you know, one of the things that fascinates me about this cycle, and people really have a hard time believing this, as you can tell, I'm a big fan of ticket splitters. My mom was an Irish Catholic Democrat, daughter of a Union Railroad worker. My dad was a German Lutheran Republican, sort of Chamber of Commerce Republican, and a Lutheran. And so we didn't talk much about religious issues at my kitchen table between the Lutheran and the Catholic. And they also didn't talk much about politics, but my dad would always vote for Bill Proxmire, who was a Democratic senator from Wisconsin for 30 years. My mom loved Ronald Reagan, as you might imagine. And I loved it in 2022 when that happened. But it'll be interesting to see if we get these sort of splits this time out. Right now, the only senator in the United States Senate out of 100 is Susan Collins. She's the only senator who won as the representative of one party in a state won by the presidential candidate in the other. So for a lot of these Democrats who are out polling right now, Tammy Baldwin here in Madison, and, you know, the race in Ohio and a couple of other, it'll be interesting to see whether there's really ticket splitting in a presidential year, which there's not been. And if you flip it to the House, so there's 435 House members, the odds are a little bit better there, but there's only 17 House seats where the person was elected who now serves with the president of a different party. So think about sort of the stark polarization in the House and the Senate, and it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, and you're also, you know, the House is going to be tilted on a lot of these like California races and New York races, places where you don't normally think that there's a lot of, swing state knife fighting, but that's really who's going to do it. And the margins are so slim there that who knows exactly what's going to happen. I agree with you, though, in terms of the ticket splitting issue. And the one thing that I would caution, especially when people are looking at 2022, is that, again, Trump wasn't on the ballot. And you could say, well, Trump's candidates were on the ballot. He wasn't 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 on the ballot. That's that. The questions I have about taking our lessons from that midterm are, number one, what is the worth of Donald Trump? We have seen it to be fairly considerable in terms of turnout. And two, has Dobbs cooled any from that point? I'm not saying that it's not an animating issue, especially for Democrats today in the same way that it was in 2022. But one of the criticisms I would have for the Kamala Harris campaign, especially when it comes to those swing voters, is that her message on abortion, take the rhetoric out, take the emotion out, her solution is the same thing that it's been for the Democratic Party for the last, you know, 30 years, that Roe is on the ballot. And it's like, I'll sign a law that restores Roe if it comes to my desk. Okay, show me on the map where that's going to happen. You know, even if you're going to say that it would be abolishing the filibuster to do it, you're still almost assuredly going to have to wait until the midterms for that. So if this is a real life and death issue, you know, when does it become so urgent that you have a plan other than trust the process?
Well, yeah, and we'll come back and talk some more about polling and polling issues and whether pollsters really have it right. But, you know, look, the bottom line is a lot of the things she tries to whip up the crowd about, including packing the Supreme Court, eliminating the Electoral College and some of that stuff, I think most centrist voters will go, ah, that's sort of how this place is wired. So back in just a minute with Justin Young. Here's the team behind Lost in the Middle. Executive producer Jeff Mayers. Producer Todd Elbaugh. Edited by Aaron Zummers. Production at Civic Media. And a quick thanks to our partners at the American Property Owners Alliance.
This podcast is brought to you by the American Property Owners Alliance. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that protects property owners and their interests. Did you know that in 10 states and Washington, D.C., the government can take more than what it is owed in property taxes in the instance of a foreclosure? From 2014 to 2021, 8,600 homes and more than $780 million in savings were lost to this practice known as home equity theft. We are working to end home equity theft everywhere it remains on the books. Visit PropertyOwnersAlliance.org to join the effort to protect property rights.
Hey, welcome back to this special edition of Lost in the Middle with my guest, Justin Young, the host of Politics, 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 sort of walking our way around issues and campaigns as we get closer and closer to Election Day. So, let me ask you, do you think pollsters have figured this out yet? Because I look at the polls today and I'm going, yikes. You know, the Brits saw this first with the Quiet Tory, right? They were wrong on Brexit. They were wrong on Scottish independence, which would make our mutual friend Heaton very happy since mm-hmm. Scotland stayed in the UK. Even in mm-hmm. the elections, you know, in 2022, they got Georgia wrong. You know, you can just sort of go after one of another. And I look at these numbers and I just sort of think, is there like 3 or 4% on the conservative side we're not seeing that the pollsters can't figure out? I think a lot of conservative voters won't answer pollsters because they see them as part of the media establishment, which they're not particularly fond of.
The apparatus, the blob, as it were. That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Is whether or not pollsters have figured out the universe of voters and whether or not that universe of voters has changed meaningfully between 2016, 2020, and now 2024. The argument for it that is made by very learned folks like my friend Michael Cohen, the man who wrote the book on the modern political campaign, not the agitator in Trump world and the former fixer. He says, yes, that you now have enough of an understanding that you can weight these polls in a way that understand the less likely to vote in off-year elections, but reliable Trump support. My argument, critical of that, is you know that Donald Trump and the Trump campaign and some of the affiliated PACs are doing voting drives at college campuses, Scott, specifically Penn State. Have you seen this?
No.
That would be anathema in almost any other presidential election, that the Republican candidate would be looking to register voters on college campuses, because that's something that is totally out of bounds. The Trump campaign has been hammering young men 18 to 35, the exact demo that goes to college football. And college football is more coded conservative than even the NFL is. It is thought to be, I don't know what happened with my...
You're enlightened. Yeah. A plot from the heavens.
Yeah, that point was so good. It just turned my lights on. Hey, you want to know what? Here we go. But they've hammered this demo. They've hammered young. They believe they've got voters that have not voted for them in that way this cycle. And you can see it in what they're doing. Why is Donald Trump on the Theo Vaughn podcast talking about cocaine use? Why is he on the Lex Fridman podcast talking about crypto? Why is he on the Aiden Ross live stream on Kick kick.com. You didn't even know that kick.com was a website, Scott, until I told you just now.
I had no
idea. It's because they are going after this demo in a way that nobody, no Republican candidate really ever has. And if you look at the widening gender gap that we have seen, there is an argument to say that that exists. So will we see the kind of crazy polling error in Trump's favor that we saw in 2016, or the more mild polling error that we saw in, actually, no, flip that. It was a mild polling error in 16. It was a larger polling error in 2020 when it was harder to poll with COVID. I don't know. I lean on saying yes. I lean on saying fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you. And the third time, I'm not gonna fall for it. I do think that he'll probably outperform his polls in these swing states, specifically the Rust Belt, which is where it's happened the most.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I mean, it's funny. I have a slide. I'm about to do some briefings for the U.S. State Department overseas. They send former members to countries and sort of explain how the Electoral College works, when, frankly, we could stop in four counties outside where I am right now and explain how the Electoral College works. But and when we did it, I actually had a slide that I kept that was a Nate Silver projection. And I think it was from like October 16th of 16, and the projection for Hillary was 83%, you know, and even the numbers in Wisconsin, she had a 6-point lead going in. Harris only has a 3-point lead right now. So is that reflect the polling errors, or reflect sort of a fundamental change in where the things are? So so who won the debate, and does it really even matter? I mean, it seems to me that, well, I mean, in the sense that I'm not, you know, the folks who turn in to watch the debate are largely probably pretty educated on this. And I think while journalists will want to say, here's the checklist of the issues, it's largely impressionistic, isn't it?
So I was a zag on the debate. I took a lot of incoming, Scott. A lot of the people on the internet were a little mean to your boy, Justin Robert Young, because my thought was, Donald Trump is as defined gets. Nobody on earth that cares to know has anything less than an almost rock solid opinion of where they think of Donald Trump right now. So him not being, you know, Kennedy in 60, not being Bill Clinton in 92 in the debate, I don't necessarily think matters all that much. Where I really thought it matters, and I still believe it matters to this day, is Kamala does need to define herself in a way that is successful. I thought that she came off as evasive. I think that a lot of her body language reminded me almost of like Al Gore in 2000. A lot of people thought Al Gore blew George W. Bush out of the water in 2000, and then you come away from it and you're like, wow, he sighed a lot. That was really weird. People didn't like that. It came off as unserious. Now, does it matter? I thought that the debate was a definitional element, an opportunity for Kamala. I didn't think that she seized it. And so as we go forward, the lesson we've seen with Kamala on the national stage is the longer she's out there, the less people like her. And I don't think that she gave people a reason, unless you were a partisan, she didn't give people a reason to like her. The biggest praise you saw of Kamala Harris's performance was that she really stuck it to Trump. That's a partisan talking point. That doesn't tell you anything about the kitchen table issues. And no matter how many times she wants to repeat, I'm from the middle class, I'm for you, I don't know if it's stuck. And that's kind of the retail political stuff that is the difference between a Bill Clinton looking dead into the barrel of the camera and saying, I feel your pain, and you believing it.
So we're just going to wrap this up here quickly. And if you remember right, Mitt Romney won the first debate against Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton won the first debate against Donald Trump. So short-term wins on the debate stage don't necessarily turn into the finish line. So my thanks to Justin Young. Great conversation. Thanks for having me on your show. And for my listeners, it's politics, politics, politics. Remember to buy his card game. We will.
Yes.
And play debate playoff. And
The Contender, the game contender of presidential debate, available on Amazon.
We'll go shopping for it. Justin, maybe we'll catch up before the final toll. If not, we'll catch up along the way. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
All right, thanks. If you like this episode of Lost in the Middle, please remember to subscribe to our podcast. And if you enjoyed it, please tell your friends and pals.
Mino and the Mayor in the morning. And the talk of Green Bay all day long. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
At Civic Media, we encourage active political engagement and remind listeners to think critically about political advertisements you may hear during this critical election year. Our stations are licensed by the FCC and are required to accept all ads for federal candidates. We also air state and local.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.